We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quint Kesnick. And of course, we have an incredible weekend of college lacrosse to talk about. Quint, we are going to start in what I think is the best series in college lacrosse. That is Syracuse versus Virginia. We didn't get it in 2020. But prior to that, the teams had played every year since 1995. It was tied 18-18, and it was tied on goals. Unbelievable. Unfortunately, that is not what we were treated to on Saturday night in the Carrier Dome, as the Hungry Dog ran faster. Syracuse Orange outpaced the Virginia Cavaliers 20-10. It is the most lopsided outcome in the series history. The only other game that was decided by 9 goals was the first time these teams played in 1938, when Syracuse won 13-4. What did you take away from Syracuse's win over Virginia?
Well, you know, if you asked me at the end of the first quarter what the final score would have been, I would have said 16-15 or 15-14, something in that range. But, you know, Virginia never could stop Syracuse after that first quarter. You know, Danny Parker got hurt, one of their shorties, and it's their defense just seemed to struggle after that. And they had no answers, and Syracuse gained confidence on every possession. I thought Tucker Dorovic was excellent. Brendan Curry was excellent. And then the other guys were put in better spots to succeed, whether it was Owen Sebald on some inverts, whether it was Lucas Quinn taking his share of midfield dodges, or whether it was Owen Hiltz as a lefty wing shooter. So, you know, we see it. We see it every year, Terry, the overreaction to week one results. We saw it in college football. You know, again, I mentioned the BYU-Navy game, 55-3. Not indicative. Yeah, BYU is a great team, but Navy had a decent season after that. They came back the next week and beat Tulane. And LSU-Mississippi State, week one in college football. KJ Costello and Mississippi State just destroyed LSU. Like, they turned out to have a horrible season, Mississippi State did. So I think in lacrosse, we put a little too much stock into some of these week one results, and we see a massive change in form in the ensuing weeks because teams improve so much. And that's compounded this year by COVID. So credit to Syracuse. Their coaching staff made some changes. They played Brett Kennedy as a pole. They, you know, changed an attack. They've changed their focal point of their offense, a little more inverting and from that razor position with Curry. It just looked a lot different and a lot better. So they deserve credit. And Virginia,
well, hold on.
They have
hold
defensive
on.
Issues.
I want to lay this out. I have the perfect way to frame this question. But first, you mentioned the offensive explosion. Let's talk about some of the numbers. After being held to just 1 goal by Army, Brendan Curry exploded for 3 goals and 4 assists. Steven Rafis had 3 and 3. He was primarily occupying that space at X. Owen Hiltz, who you mentioned, lefty wing shooter, the freshman, had 3 goals and 2 assists in his first career start. Coming away from Virginia's win over Loyola, you pointed out, isolated, some of the defensive issues that Virginia had. So setting that aside, I mean, really what this game came down to, in my opinion, is that Syracuse just outperformed them in every facet, offense, defensively, and in special teams. So what I'm interested in, and we'll get back to Virginia's defense in a second, but what aspect surprised you the most? The fact that Jacob Faup won 22 of 33 against that faceoff unit led by Petey LaSala that had been the best in the country coming into this game, or that Syracuse's defense was able to limit Virginia to 10 goals, especially limiting Matt Moore to 0 goals on 10 shots.
Yeah, when Matt Moore goes 0-1 and Doc Sakin is no factor with 0-0, it's going to be a long day for Virginia. Quite honestly, their bench is giving them nothing this year. I mean, you got Bertrand, Cormier, Laviano, Schellenberger, and Moore have been the guys. There's really nobody else. Sandra Dixon had a couple moments this year. Pete Garneau has done very little. So they're still looking for answers. And so when Moore and Aiken end up with goose eggs, there's not much there. And so that was a surprise to me. The other surprise was how Syracuse was able to clear effectively against the 10-man. The 10-man's been so effective for Virginia this season. It's really created fear. It's dictated tempo. It's led to goal scoring chances and extra possessions. So that Syracuse being able to clear and winning faceoffs went a long way in my eyes into just steamrolling. And I thought Alex Rode for Virginia was a bright spot. I thought Charlie Bertrand was a bright spot. outside of those guys, you know, there was a bunch of players at the end of the game. I had to go back. I'm like, was this guy dressed? Did he play? Because Anish and Kark never mentioned his name. And some of those guys are really high profile guys. And when you have three or four of those guys have off games like that, you're not going to win against a quality opponent. So I thought Syracuse, the faceoff surprised me a bit, but their ability to clear against a 10-man was sensational.
You mentioned Alex Rode. He had missed Virginia's last two games due to COVID-19 protocol. You mentioned he returned, made the start, made 17 saves. It was interesting watching the broadcast. They talked about whether or not Bobby Gavin could get a look if Rode was rusty or anything like that. And I thought maybe early we've seen Lars do this, kind of pull the hook, and he stuck with Rode. And I agree with you. I thought he played well despite finishing below 50%. But you mentioned Virginia's defense, so let's come back to that. This is a unit that has tremendous personnel, but I agree with you. Danny Parker's injury seemed like it jarred loose some of the consistency and continuity. Kyle Kolodji, Cade Sostad, Quentin Matsui, those are three top-end close defensemen. The LSM play led by Jared Connors, and I was particularly impressed by Ben Ware early in the season. John Fox is a short stick D-middy that people really like. So what is it in your estimation or in your eyes that they're falling short? Why is this defense
Loyola, I got to go back and watch the Syracuse tape again. I watched it live. But to go back and analyze every goal and take notes, I was not doing that. Against Loyola, we saw isolated incidents where different defenders just had boneheaded plays, whether it was Sostad being beat backdoor on that clear, whether it was the interior defense. Bauer had a rough day inside against Loyola. And if every guy makes one mistake, you know, against a quality team, you're going to be giving up 12 goals. I mean, because you have 6 to 9 players who are in there. Okay, if every guy makes a mistake that leads to a goal, you're in trouble. Somebody has to play a pretty clean game. And you know, Connors and Sostad, you know, again, these are really good players. These are great players. They didn't impose themselves in that game. They didn't have their name called enough. They didn't make plays off the ground. They didn't block passes. They didn't carry up the field the way I'm used to seeing. They didn't win their matchup. I have a lot of respect for those guys. They're really good athletes, good players. And for whatever reason, they had an off night.
And at the other end of the field, you mentioned Syracuse making some changes, particularly Mitch Wyckoff, who missed the first game against Army due to injury, made the start. The Gettysburg transfer played pretty well. And I don't want to say that it allowed them to move Brett Kennedy up top, but it seemed like it allowed them to move Brett Kennedy up top. And Carr talked about it during the broadcast. In space seems to be where Kennedy thrives and plays his best at that long stick midi position. Certainly when he broke through as a young guy, that was the position that he was doing it in. And so to that extent, it feels like he's kind of returning to the spot where he should be. And, you know, there is such an it's hard to isolate or evaluate the play of short stick D-middies, because when you get dodged that frequently, it's hard to keep track of your batting average. How frequently did you turn a guy back versus how often did you get beat and did your team have to slide to you? But when I watch Syracuse's D-middies play, I just like what I see. They play with tenacity. They are good at, you know, kind of in between the lines. I think that what you saw against Army in terms of the precise way in which that offense took advantage of the vulnerabilities in the middle of the defense might be similar to what we've seen out of Virginia in the last 2 weeks. And the fact is that Syracuse responded. Now, it's possible that Virginia didn't take advantage of those weaknesses, right?
Yeah.
That the opponent
I mean, you watch the Army game. The one thing you want to do against Syracuse is get the ball behind the goal. Whether it's with Nick Turn or inverts. And Virginia, for whatever reason, didn't do that very much. That's my first plan of attack when I play Syracuse. You invert the formation. You make those defenders play off ball with their head on a swivel. Get the ball behind when you're defending the orange. I will say, Dearth and Kennedy, as good of a 1-2 combo as you'll see, both on the wings, athletically in transition, and just physically. I mean, those guys are monsters. They're animals. And, you know, Cuse tightened up some things on defense. But I wasn't thrilled with Virginia's approach, because I think Cuse is a team you want to get the ball behind, throw some picks at them, create some switches, and then do some action inside. You know, put two guys in a high-low or two guys next to each other with some picks and switches. And I think Army exposed a weakness that Virginia didn't really capitalize on.
Well, fortunately for the Cavaliers, they don't have to wait long in order to get back on the field. They've got High Point in Charlottesville on Wednesday, and then next Saturday they host Air Force before beginning ACC, well, not beginning, continuing ACC play against North Carolina.
One thing I want to add to that, Terry, that's a TV game. I believe it's Wednesday afternoon, ACC Network. That's the only TV game this week, okay, with basketball championship week and a lot of conference tournaments. There's no games on BTN, and there's no games on ESPNU or ACC Network other than the Wednesday High Point Virginia game. So enjoy it, matinee on Wednesday.
And certainly when it comes to High Point playing matinees against ACC opponents, they do not disappoint, even though they didn't put in quite the effort against the Tar Heels on Saturday that they did about 10 days prior. Syracuse, meanwhile, hosts Vermont on Saturday. That is a game that I believe was originally supposed to be their first game of the season. So good to see that they were able to get the Catamounts into their schedule later in the year. And then they've got a really nice in-state slate beyond that with Stony Brook and Hofstra before they head to Duke for their first road matchup on March 25th. Continuing on, the second biggest result of the weekend, I think, is a dominating performance once again, an offensive explosion this time for the Rutgers Scarlet Knights in Columbus, 22-12 victors over Ohio State. Rutgers now with wins over Ohio State and Penn State to move to 2-0. Ohio State 1-1 after they had beaten Johns Hopkins in their season opener. Quint, take your victory lap. You were right. I was wrong.
If you watched the Rutgers-Penn State game, you couldn't be unimpressed with Rutgers. I was really impressed with what I saw. I thought Penn State played a darn good game that day and could have won. There was a couple plays here and there that went against them, a pipe shot that led to a Rutgers goal on the other side, a Rutgers goal with, you know, little time left in a quarter. That was a tight game. And so I was more bullish on Rutgers off of that close win against Penn State than I was watching Ohio State's game against Johns Hopkins, which after jumping out to that early lead, I thought it was kind of a sloppy and it didn't look like an elite game. It was Hopkins had opportunities that they kind of threw away, both in transition and then settled sets. And I thought that Ohio State, they walked away with a kind of a handily win. But if you looked at closer, I wasn't as impressed as I was with Rutgers' one-goal win over Penn State. So it's not easy to go to Columbus and get the W, though, or especially early in the year. They played the game outdoors, which was to Rutgers' benefit. And after a fairly close first quarter, Rutgers just exploded in the second and third quarters, proving that they could play fast. And that was the other thing in the Penn State game, Terry, if you watch it. They scored and settled. You know, Kirst is really good in early offense when they do their sub game because he's got so much space. He's playing attack this year, okay? Let's get that straight. He's not a midfielder. He's playing that right-handed upper point man on the attack unit. And when he catches an early offense, there's all sorts of space, and he makes things happen. And then transition and settled and extra man. So they can play at two speeds, and they can score in a lot of different ways. Their attack is super veteran and very skilled, with Mullins and Cheryl Mbides. The only thing, I think I mentioned this last week, the only thing they don't do is ride. They got a bunch of old guys, old, big, slow guys playing attack, and they're not like in the riding business. That's not their game. But, man, they can light it up.
So I've got kind of two things I want to go over. The first is last week against Penn State was the Connor Kirst show, like you mentioned. This week, the offense was much more balanced. Kieran Mullins and Adam Trelambides both finished with 6 points. David Sprock and Knobloch, the freshman, both had 5 points. And then Kirst had 4 goals, although I will note that he took 13 shots in order to get there. The game was 3-3 at one point, and then Rutgers scored 6 straight in the last 5 minutes of the first quarter and the first 5 minutes of the second quarter in order to blow the game open. And then I also thought there was another important moment in the third quarter when they didn't take their foot off the gas. They scored 4 straight goals in a 4-minute stretch in order to turn a 14-8 lead into an 18-8 lead, and they killed the game. And I'm just pointing this out. We're going to talk about some of these issues later on in the podcast, but those 4 goals in a prior year, pre-shot clock, wouldn't have been as important as they are now. Simply stating that strangling a game, and it's not to say that a 6-goal lead isn't valuable or isn't good or whatever, it is, but strangling a game has a lot of value, particularly when these schedules are all disrupted and really good teams are playing each other all the time. Like, killing a game has a lot of value, and so not taking their foot off the gas. Like you said, outdoors in Columbus, that's indicative. That's meaningful, and I wouldn't sleep on that. I started to rewatch this game. I haven't made it all the way through, but I got a couple of notes I want to get to. But the biggest thing when you look at the stat line and separates these two teams in this game, in my opinion, Rutgers took 58 shots and Ohio State took 31.
Yeah, no, that's a strong stat. You know, they upgraded the faceoff position with a transfer from St. John's, John DeGenio. He's doing great this year, so that's an upgrade. I thought their D against Penn State was mistake-free. Okay, nothing blatant. If Penn State made a good play, they scored, so what? But they didn't give them any freebies. They handled the ball well. And then the midfield depth, who was it? Scott scored the game winner in that game. Tommy Coyne had an assist this week. David Sprock, big game with 5 points. And the freshman, Shane Knobloch, who is this kid? He's on fire. I mean
he's
fire.
New Jersey lacrosse royalty. His mom was the coach at Morristown for a long time. And
he's a stud, man. He can shoot it and he can dodge with two hands, a nice split, kind of a north-south type kid. He's off to an amazing start. You know, that'll probably cool down, but congratulations to him. Where was he on your top 100 list?
He wasn't, as a matter of fact. Actually,
that's a great example. Again, there's so many good players out there that guys fall through the cracks for whatever reason. But he's playing at you know, top. He's the top freshman in the country right now, in my eyes. The midfield position in two key games to put up the production he did. And whether he can continue this, we'll see. But certainly he fits, and he's off to a good start, which from a confidence standpoint, for freshman middies, you rarely see.
So in the first 20 minutes of the game that I've watched so far, there were a couple things that stood out. And I'm building on this because this is what I took away from watching Ohio State Hopkins live the week prior. I was so, I don't want to say impressed, but just transfixed by Ohio State's defense. And there were two reasons. Number one, because to me, their personnel is big enough and strong enough. Now, whether or not they're fast and quick enough, I think remains to be seen. But they were big and strong enough that I thought you can go toe-to-toe and win your matchup. But that was what surprised me, is that they threw this five-man zone with a backside guy that would bump all over the place, and it seemed like really frenetic and kind of erratic, and it was hard for me to put my finger on exactly what was happening. And so when I was watching, I really kind of isolated in on Rutgers' second and third goals. Sherlon Beattie's had both of them. They both came from the lefty wing. One of them came on bad communication in a slipped pick in a two-man game when they put Ryan Tarafenko into the two-man game, and he stayed with Sherlon Beattie's when it looked like he was going to go back. His defenseman, number 37, thought that he was going to stay with the picker, so he didn't hedge out far enough, and as a result, Sherlon Beattie's had enough space, canned a shot. And then a next possession, or the next goal-scoring possession, they were in this zone, and Sherlon Beattie's just took advantage of the fact that they weren't stretched or extended far enough out. To me, I'm really focusing on Ohio State's defense, because when you compare the Big Ten to the ACC, you expect that these games are going to be in the 10 to 14 goal range, whereas the ACC games are more likely to be in the 15 to 18 goal range, the way that we saw Syracuse, Virginia set the tone. So if that's the case, then obviously the value of a stop becomes incrementally more important, incrementally more valuable. And I think Ohio State is, now with the clarity of Rutgers' win, it appears that we clearly have a top tier of Maryland and Rutgers, and it'll be interesting to see how that tier, those two teams compare. And then we've got what may be a second tier of just Ohio State, Ohio State and Penn State, or potentially Ohio State, Penn State, and Hopkins. We'll see how Johns Hopkins continues to improve coming off of that opening loss to the Buckeyes. And so ultimately, what I'm wondering is Ohio State's defense going to emerge good enough in order for its defense to be the reason that they close the gap on the top tier? Because from what I've seen so far, offensively, I think they can manufacture goals in like high leverage situations, but I don't think they can score 15 consistently.
Yeah.
So as a result, if they can get into 10-10 dogfights, I think that Jack Myers and Trey LeClaire and Griffin Hughes can score goals late in games, and potentially this is the pathway to them winning in College Park, for example, and being one of the teams that could potentially upset Maryland in the regular season. Because if not that, then, I mean, is the Big Ten as simple as how the two Rutgers-Maryland games get decided?
Well, is the Big Ten a two-bid league, or will they, you know, the third team is going to take some losses? How many, and what's it look like in the ACC and out-of-conference play for that league? Obviously, the Big Ten doesn't have that luxury. But going back to Ohio State, you really got to understand the big picture, because they were shorthanded in terms of time going into the Hopkins game. Okay, lack of full field, really not prepared anywhere close to what you'd want to be prepared for an opener. And they win, and it's kind of turns out to be a big margin win. And you start feeling good about yourself as a player, and it's not really justified. And so this is kind of that wake-up call. They will improve. They're extremely well coached. Nick Myers does a great job. They'll figure it out. Offensively, they'll figure it out whether they're a man team or a zone team. I have a lot of confidence in them improving off of that game. So the only thing that really upset me was that usually they play a little better at home. That was kind of a clunker for them to lose so significantly, and to give up that amount of goals at home is a rarity.
On Friday night, Maryland topped Penn State 13-7 in Panzer Stadium. Jared Bernhardt was fantastic with 3 goals and 4 assists. Dylan Maltz had 4-1. Logan Wisnoskis had 3-2. The Terps were able to overcome a face-off disadvantage, but I thought Logan McNaney did a really nice job in net for the Terps. And ultimately, to me, the story of this game and potentially the story of the season for the Nittany Lions is going to be, where do they find offense? They didn't have a guy crack the three-point barrier. TJ Malone had a goal and an assist. I mean, I don't want to overreact. I don't want to hit the panic button, but you're 0-2, you're Penn State. You were in the Final Four the last time you played a complete season. You carried a lot of that momentum into the shortened 2020 season, and we just haven't seen it. Mac O'Keefe limited to a goal in this game against Maryland. What did you take away from this, and are there answers available on this Penn State roster?
A lot. I watched this game live. I was impressed with the game in general. I thought it was a fast-played, really hard-played game. Guys were going at it. It had great ground ball scraps. I thought Maryland's defense was outstanding. I thought Ray Hill, McCarr, Grill, not only did they block passes and play good man-to-man defense, but they got the ball off the carpet. Their ground ball totals were outstanding. So anytime Penn State made a mistake, it was kind of like a one and done. They got the ball up and out and cleared it. Calderon came in the second half and did a better job facing off. I thought Maryland capitalized on Penn State's over-aggressive slides all day long. You break that tape down. Maryland had 11 assists. 10 of those goals, in my eyes, were caused by overzealous slides, where Bernhardt presses the GLE and they go. He's clearly not dodging to score a goal yet, and yet they go, and there's Wisnoskis on the backside for a layup. Another situation, a defender leaves his man to chase a loose ball. So two Penn State guys going against Wisnoskis, who happens to get it. Next thing you know, you're down a man on the backside, Bernhardt slam dunk. So there's an overzealous sliding that exists in Penn State's defense, and Maryland was perfectly equipped to take advantage of that. And then I see that.
All right, fine. All of that is well and good. But the fact of the matter
it corresponds to their offense too, Terry.
Okay, well, let me just make this point, which is that holding Maryland to 13, you can win that game 3-4 times out of 10. Only scoring 7, you're going to lose that game 9 out of 10 times.
Well, okay, then it correlates to their offense too, as I'm saying. They seem to dodge in circles. They seem to dodge not to expect to beat a man, but to feed, because they're so used to playing their defense in practice that when you approach a guy and take 3 steps, there's the double, there's the show. And so they're such a pass-happy team. Like, beat your man and score a goal. It's John Danowski, straight from John Danowski. Who can beat their man and score a goal? Okay, when you do that, the other team's got to respect you. Who can beat their man and spin it? Okay, then who can be the transition player to change the ball to weak side to strong side? And you know, obviously without Grant Amen, we're not seeing that ball reversal. Their best offense has been their wing dodges and Dan Reum from the invert. O'Keefe just doesn't seem to be getting the same quality of looks he got when Amen was there. I think they have the parts to be okay this year. I'm not going to downgrade him yet, because I know they too are extremely well coached. Their effort cannot be questioned. They got to clean up a lot of things, though. You know, typically the middle of the field stuff is what has held Penn State back. The clearing in the middle of the field, there's too many boneheaded turnovers, clearing up the box side, running into double teams. They've got to clean that up somehow. And I think they'll figure it out offensively. You know, maybe it means taking this system that was so effective for the last 2 years and tweaking it and changing it a little to maybe more, you know, apply to this personnel. So basically they're trying to run the same offense without Grant. And I'm not sure that that's the best decision. So I'm confident that Coach Hawes and Coach Tambroni will figure that out. And I haven't lost confidence in Penn State. I still got them, you know, ranked somewhere in the 10, 11, 12 range.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it'll be fun to watch because obviously they were one not so I made the argument that they were the best offense in the history of college lacrosse in 2018 and then that or I'm sorry, in 2019 and then that kind of got extended into 2020, but you know, there's a long way there's a lot of space between that and this group. And to your point, I give a lot of credit to the staff, not just for identifying him and bringing him in via recruiting and then developing him, but also to your other point, building an offense that complemented his skill set. And it doesn't come as a surprise because all the things that you said about Ohio State in terms of the way that they've been limited time-wise, et cetera, are true for Penn State as well in terms of the amount of time that they've had the full group together, et cetera. And so, yeah, we can expect them to continue to get better, but the problem is that the floor is very high, meaning that there's very little margin for error in terms of
the quality. They've dug themselves a tough hole right now. And the schedule is certainly difficult to open the way they did on the road at Rutgers and then home against a very good Maryland team. So their back's against the wall. The time is now for them. They got to go. Another loss to, you know, as you said, they'll go from the middle tier Big Ten to the bottom tier Big Ten. And the bottom tier Big Ten is nowhere close to an NCAA tournament team.
Let's talk about a couple of the debutantes. Notre Dame 19, Robert Morris 7. I paid very close attention to this game.
Yeah, I saw that. I was amazed. They got guys. They got guys that I didn't even know were on their roster.
It was unbelievable. Like,
who are these people?
So that to me is the most important thing that you could take away. And so here's the qualifier. The fan listening to this, I would say 20-30% understand who Robert Morris is and can properly put into context what a 12-goal win over Robert Morris is. And the other 80% might say, oh, Robert Morris, like, I don't even know where that school is. So what I think that it's important to qualify the competition in order to properly contextualize what this performance means for Notre Dame. So Robert Morris is a team that had Maryland on the ropes in the NCAA tournament a couple years ago. They're a team that played Duke incredibly tough on Super Bowl Sunday before the Blue Devils pulled out a 4-goal win late. So really high quality competition. But in addition to that, they also play an incredibly unique style. I was talking to John Torpy after High Points went over Robert Morris early in the season, and he compared it to playing an option offense in football in the sense that the things they try to manipulate in the substitution game and the way that they get easy goals that way is unlike any other team that you'll play in Division I. And when you compound that with the fact that their defensemen are enormous, love to get upfield and stay on and play offense, so they spark a lot of transition that way. And then separately, that their attackmen are all NLL starters. It's just a very unique team to play against. So for Notre Dame, one of the
unique,
things...
You know what's unique about me? Is they want no part of playing defense because they haven't been able to keep anybody under 16, 18, 21 goals this year.
That is exactly right. Notre Dame, the biggest storyline, in my opinion, is going to be they were 2-3 last year, and they were clearly not good enough to beat Maryland. And then they came up, I don't want to say just short, but a couple goals short against Denver and Ohio State. They needed to be better. Now, was there enough talent on the roster internally in order to get better? I don't know. You also had to consider that they lost Brian Costabile, who I think showed himself to be with Grant Ament as the best rookie in the PLL last year. So they needed an infusion of talent. And yesterday they got contributions from 8 guys that were not on the roster, 5 transfers and 3 freshmen. And when that happens, particularly at a place like Notre Dame with a team that has a very strong culture, a very unique and firm identity, I think that the balance that needs to be struck is how do we infuse this talent and get their contributions without disrupting the core? And I thought that yesterday was about as good of a balance of those two things in terms of Pat Cavanaugh had 2 goals and 7 assists, right? And Liam Entenmann did a great job defensively. Jack Hilty and Arden Cohen were excellent. Charles Leonard, even despite being in a backup role from a faceoff standpoint, was really good, but Kyle Gallagher was awesome, right? And so Kyle Thornton was fantastic as the third defenseman. And Will York, Sean Leahy, they all got goals. And I felt like, again, it was just kind of this amalgam of a, I don't want to call it a new team, but in many respects, this is not the Notre Dame team we saw last year. And so the point I'm getting at is that they only play 10 games. And so as a result, you got to take a little bit more out of each Notre Dame game from an analysis standpoint, because there just aren't going to be any as many opportunities to see who they actually are as a typical team in a typical season.
Their schedule looks very different this year from what it has in the past. And I give them a lot of credit in the last 10 years. Nobody has played out of conference the quality of teams that Notre Dame has. Their annual series with Denver and Ohio State will not be played this year. But as you were saying, 15 different guys got in the scoreboard, okay? And there's some names here that, quite honestly, David Lipka, we know him from Syracuse. Where's Sean Leahy from?
Providence.
Where is Will York from?
Bucknell.
Eric Dobson.
Freshman from Florida.
Okay, and then we got the normal, and then we got the defense that I love so much, and we got the normal faces, the Jack of Boyces, the Westland, the Kavanaugh, the Quinn McCann.
I would say
we got
that.
We got Mikey Drake. We got Mikey Drake back in the mix, who was so highly touted as a freshman and kind of fell off the map, and now he's back. He's got the best split dodge in America, that kid. So I'm encouraged. I thought that was a very, very encouraging start. It shows you, you know, free agency in college lacrosse. They have a great business school grad program, and they're reaping the rewards of that. And I think it's fantastic.
I got called out for not making enough of Pat Cavanaugh's performance. And I just want to say that, like, he was awesome. There's no question about it. But the reason that I didn't make a big deal of it is because the game was kind of already decided when he really got into his groove. I believe his second assist came on the 7th goal. And at that point, I think it was 7-1 or 7-2.
Well, you know, there's a lot of that going around, Terry. I mean, there's stuff I see on the internet, guys who make an amazing shot and the goal goes viral. And I'm watching the game saying, wow, this guy played lousy. Yeah, he had that one play, but he also left 3 goals on the table and had 4 turnovers. You know, it's like you really can't believe everything you see and read these days, especially when social media magnifies the wow play.
One more point I want to make. The fact that Wheaton Jagaboys produced 3 goals. I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be the midfielder of the year, but I am saying he's going to be the midfielder on Notre Dame's team who draws the pole most consistently. And Notre Dame, I think, is going to be a national championship contender. And Wheaton Jagaboys will have games where he produces 5 points. So ipso facto, he is going to be a midfielder of the year candidate. And the fact that he had a very quiet game comparatively, and they didn't need him, it's similar to, I would compare it to Rutgers. The fact that, you know, Sean Beattie and Mullins were not the headlines in their win over Penn State, which kind of allowed them to be the headline in their win over Ohio State. And I think that that's what you're going to see out of Jack Boyce going forward.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in scoring depth. As you know, again, Virginia proved me wrong when they won the national championship. They were so reliant on their top five. But for Notre Dame to have options, Maryland didn't get much from their bench. And that's always been an issue in my mind, because later in the year, injuries, hotter weather, you know, now with the shot clock, you need a second midfield that can produce if you want to win a close game. Because when you're playing other good teams, their great players counteract your great players. So great against great, it's the second tier that can win a national championship for you. I've said that many times. You know, roster spots 11 through 20 often determine, you know, the shorties, the third shorty, the second midfield, the fourth attackman, the fourth defender. Like, those guys make a big difference in May.
Couple more games that we want to whip through quickly. Albany 15, Colgate 9. This game was close in the third quarter, and then Albany blew the game open in the fourth. Jacob Patterson,
like this year.
4 goals, 4 assists. Camden Hay, 2 goals.
I'm buying Albany stock.
4 assists, including a very pretty behind-the-back highlight that I'm sure you've seen by now. Most important takeaway for me from this game, no Tohoka Nanacoke. Reached out to a team spokesman, could only confirm that he was unavailable. Nanacoke was tweeting during the game, which suggests to me that he was not on the sideline, which suggests to me that it was more likely a COVID issue than an injury issue, and it'll be a matter of time until he's able to return.
Scott Marr texted me last night. And Elijah Gash started a defense. Kid from Wisconsin, Green Bay. His dad is Sam Gash. Sam Gash, I think, played for the Ravens, but he played in the NFL forever. He's an assistant coach now for the Packers. Gash ends up going to some D2 school. I get sent a tape. Okay, I'm watching a tape of this tall defender running circles around people from Minnesota high school lacrosse, and I'm like, am I seeing things, or is this kid, like, really good? Well, I sent the tape to four people, sent it to four Division I coaches. Scotty Marr followed up on it. Scotty got the kid into school. The kid started. I get a text last night. Gash is going to be a player. Not only a player, but he's going to be one of the best defenders in the country. He pitchforked two kids and threw them out of bounds. He was blown away in his first start. And to me, it just proves that, like, there are kids out there. There are really good players out there who are being overlooked, who, for whatever reason, maybe they play multiple sports in high school. They come from a traditional, you know, non-hotbed. They don't get to play. Maybe their family can't afford to play in these club extravaganzas that cost thousands of dollars. But I really believe we're going to hit an era right now where there's going to be some crazy good players who fall through the cracks because of those factors. And the hustling coaches who get their tentacles out to areas like Arizona,
where Jacob Patterson's
from Arizona. Yeah. Correct. Green Bay, Wisconsin. I just think that you got to have a willingness to dig a little deeper nowadays in terms of recruiting.
Continuing on, Georgetown once again holds an opponent to one goal and puts up an outrageous goal total. Georgetown
sickest thing ever.
16-1 over St. John's. No Gibson Smith, no problem.
It's I've never seen anything like it. Okay, to do that once in the shot clock era, and then to do it again the following week, just ridiculous numbers. Owen McElroy, their goalie, is like 89%. Their extra man down defense is perfect. They're starting to get offense. I don't know how to quantify it. Like, I've got them ranked a lot lower than everybody else because they haven't beaten a top 15 team or top 10 team in a while. You'll see. I write about it in my poll. I like the Swamp Dogs. I think they're really good. It's just kind of hard to gauge.
By my math, their opponents have had the ball 57 times in two games, and they've scored twice. So can you imagine playing one-on-one with somebody, and they get the ball 57 times, and they only score twice?
Look, Villanova bounced out of that game and put up a lot of goals against Marquette. That was a nice turnaround for the Wildcats. Again, week one, don't overreact to week one. So you'll take the 16-1, you say, okay, maybe that was, they come right back the next week and almost shut out St. John's. Unfortunately their schedule, it's conference only this year. And it hasn't been that tough recently, but you know, they play the Mount midweek and they play Marquette next weekend. So I'm saying after this week, they'll probably still be under 10 goals allowed after four games.
They do play Loyola at the end of the season. Loyola coming off of a 20-8 victory over Utah. And the only thing I quickly want to say about the Greyhounds is that Evan James looks like an attackman. He's doing a really nice job filling in for Joey Kamish,
who's out with him. Yeah, 2 weeks in a row, right?
Yep. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how Kamish reincorporates himself into the Loyola offense when he comes back. He's a good player, but I don't think there's going to be room for him on this attack lineup. So I think he's going to have to figure out a way to make an effect coming out of the box. One more game I want to get to.
Do I get to congratulate my Hopkins Blue Jays on this
podcast?
Yeah,
absolutely. Go ahead.
Pete Milliman, congratulations. First win as head coach. Nicknamed now the Milkman because of that typo in my poll 2 weeks ago. Joey Epstein, must be a podcast listener, 6 goals. And it was a step forward. I think Hopkins has some talent on offense. I do believe that. I do believe that they have enough skill. They have enough talent on offense to score in that league. Still, you know, the question marks, obviously, with the defensive midfield and their defense. But it was a positive step forward. And if they can keep improving and get some young guys, to influx of some of their young athletes onto the field, they got a shot. They play Maryland this week in what we regard as the greatest rivalry in college lacrosse. Not that newly found, that nouveau riche one, the Virginia-Syracuse rivalry that basically started like 2 years ago.
One other thing about this game Hopkins did a really nice job on Josh Sawada, holding him to just 2 assists. He had 4-1 against Maryland. So Maryland defense that you're talking about as being so good in terms of killing possessions against Penn State, failed to mention that trio of Rahill, Grill, and McCarr combined for 14 ground balls, which is a big number for three close defensemen. Obviously, Hopkins brought something to the table in order to limit Sawada. And I haven't watched this game yet. It's one that I've got circled in terms of diving into, but certainly I would echo your congratulations for the new coaching staff. The last game that I want to touch on is North Carolina 27, High Point 12, for two reasons. It raises our analysis question, which is, why are there so many blowouts? And second is, it hits on a news item, which is that goalie Caton Johnson entered the transfer portal this week. So with respect to the blowouts, the average margin of victory on Saturday was 9.5 goals. That's a big number. I haven't done enough analysis to know how much of an outlier that was, but why do you think there are so many blowouts early in the season?
Well, usually I think the schedule has one thing to do with it this year. I think that the lack of fall, I think the lack of true training camp. I thought we saw it in college football, talking to defensive coordinators. They felt like they were really ill-prepared. Texas A&M, Mike Elko in particular, when I spoke to him, they lost by 4 touchdowns early to Alabama, and then it ended up running the table. And I asked him what happened. He goes, with their abbreviated preparation, and I think this is the same in lacrosse. Like, you just don't have the answers for what teams are thrown at you. And so that's one thing. The other thing, I think just emotionally, it's a tough time for everyone right now. And I think we're all weak and we're all vulnerable. And there's a lot going on. And so when a game slips away, it's just a game. But I do think the schedule contributed to it. We had some games that looked like they could go that way, and they did. But it's eye opening to see 22-10, 27-12. Really one-sided games that I've always bragged in recent years that the early season, how many one-goal games. I can remember weeks, Terry, where we had a dozen one-goal games. How many one-goal games were there last weekend?
Three. I'm sorry.
Hofstra Stony Brook was close, and UMBC was close.
Towson-Richmond and Holy Cross Sacred Heart.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're hopeful that, this is something that kind of shifts gears and gets back to those close games that we are used to going forward. Quint, the lone top 20 team yet to make their debut, the UMass Minutemen. We are anxiously awaiting Greg Cannella's squad to take the field for the first time. But other than that, every top 20 team is out of the gate. Lehigh, with their 24-10 win over NJIT, was the other top 20 debutant this week, and in total you counted what, 18 teams including the Aggies that have yet to
outside of the Ivy and Hampton who are not participating this year,
right,
who have not played a game yet. Is that accurate?
I think so. The MAC, it would, they're only playing conference opponents and they start on Saturday, and I would imagine that a handful of NEC teams, including Hobart, I was looking at their schedule, are in that mix as well. So there's still a lot of teams left to make their debut. A lot of meat on the bone in terms of analyzing early season play. But any final thoughts as we wrap up this Quick Restart podcast?
No, I just felt that there's obviously the one TV game is Wednesday, High Point in Virginia, Wednesday afternoon. I think from a key game standpoint, that Ohio State-Penn State game is really important for both teams. That's such an important upcoming game. And then we start the league slate in a couple other leagues. So I think from an important standpoint, Ohio State, Penn State takes a back seat to none. And I think it'll be really interesting to watch a Hopkins-Maryland rivalry. And I'm eager to see High Point on TV again on Wednesday.
Well, that's a great way to end it. Quint, thank you as always. To our listeners, thank you for spending your time with us. We appreciate it. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. We'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts, and we'll be back next Monday with another Quick Restart.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.